Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to
We Are All One Planet, All One People of Earth, All One Planet, sharing our living, our dying, our birth, and we won't stand by watching her die, hearing her cry and deny. We live as she lives, we die as she dies.
Welcome to Your Turn to Speak with your host, Beth Miller. All points of view must be brought to light if we're to reach the wisest solutions to challenges we face. Guests on Your Turn to Speak have unusual insights to bring to the collective conversation. They have been invited because of the positive impact of their loving presence on Earth. Though their ideas may be hidden by the glare of the mainstream focus, their perspectives are guaranteed to inspire and enrich us all. And now, here's your host, Beth Miller.
Welcome to Your Turn to Speak. I'm your host, Beth Miller. Recently, I read a newspaper article that touched my heart, and it relates to an issue we will be hearing about from our guest this evening. The article, written by Phil Windsor, pastor of Westminster Presbyterian Church here in Auburn, New York, describes his reactions to seeing the 1998 movie version of Victor Hugo's classic, Les Miserables. Many of you are familiar with the story, whose hero, Jean Valjean, spent 19 years of hard labor in prison for stealing bread. The film begins as Valjean is just released from jail. And since word spread rather quickly around town that he was an ex-con, nobody really wanted to help him. Unable to find food or shelter, finally he was directed to the bishop's house, and there, to his surprise, he was offered dinner and a place to stay the night. As Valjean sits at the bishop's table, he casually comments that, with some food and a good night's sleep, he will be a new man. During the night, however, Valjean slips out of bed, sneaks into the dining room, and steals the bishop's silver. When the bishop hears a noise and comes to investigate, there is just a moment when the two men stand looking at each other. Then Valjean strikes the bishop in the head and flees with the silverware. Sometime later that day, the police arrive at the bishop's house with Valjean in handcuffs. They tell the bishop Valjean claims he was given the silver. The bishop then does something surprising. He lies. He tells the police, "Yes, that's right, I gave him the silverware, and I'm glad that you brought him back because I forgot to give him the candelabra, and they're worth much more." And with that, the bishop asks the housekeeper to bring the candelabra, which he then stuffs into the convict's bag. When the police leave, Valjean stands looking confused and asks the bishop why he did that. "Don't ever forget you've promised to become a new man. Jean Valjean, my brother, you no longer belong to evil. With this silver, I've bought your soul. I've ransomed you from fear and hatred. And now I give you back to God." Phil Windsor's article notes that the rest of the movie is about how Jean Valjean indeed does become a new man. But the Reverend writes, "When the bishop spoke those words the first time I saw this movie, the impact for me was almost physical. It was as powerful as anything I ever witnessed on film." He goes on to say, "I know it's just a movie based on a novel, and many of us could cite examples of stories that didn't turn out as well. I know I could. But those of us who claim to be people of faith, it seems to me, have a stake in believing that redemption is possible. Of all people, we should be interested in what is called restorative justice as compared to retributive justice, which is simply the desire to punish." I just thought I would take the time to relate the eloquent message in Reverend Windsor's article as a way of introducing my guest this evening. Melissa White is a social worker who assists individuals who have criminal convictions. She will share some of her experiences and thoughts about what we as a society need to do to help prisoners successfully reenter the mainstream upon their release. She holds a degree in social work from the Greater Rochester Collaborative Masters of Social Work Program, a program between State University of New York at Brockport and Nazareth College. It is an honor to have you with us tonight, Melissa. And now it's your turn to speak.
Well, hi, Beth, and I'd like to say thank you for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to talk to everyone.
Well, it's my delight to have you with us. So why don't we just begin by having you talk with us a little bit about some of your life experiences that led you to decide to become a social worker.
Oh, well, I'd say it all probably began with just about every job that I've had. I've always worked with people. Originally, I started out working with troubled youth that were been placed in residential facilities. And it just seemed that was my calling. I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I liked working with the kids, and then I moved on and I worked with youth that were pregnant or parenting or at risk for parenting. And I just reached a plateau where I couldn't really go any further, you know, due to my education. So I decided it was time to go back and to pursue my master's degree in social work. And it was something that I was very passionate about, which I think really helped in drive me to be successful in achieving my goal.
That's great. It's really quite an accomplishment to get a master's degree. I've always wanted one myself. I've had 6 years of college, but I still haven't got my master's. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. And I was actually a non-traditional student, so I finished and graduated my master's degree when I was 44. So
wow.
It's never too late.
Well, thank you. That gives me some encouragement. I was wondering, did you have any religious or spiritual values that played a role in your decision?
I think it was probably a combination of both, you know, to always try to look for the good in people. I mean, just every day you can, in a conversation, you can hear so many negatives about an individual, and a handful of times that you're going to hear somebody speak well of another individual. So I just didn't really like that. I would prefer to see the good. You know, I mm-hmm. obviously acknowledge that there are, you know, some negatives that exist, but I think if we start to focus more on the good, then we're going to accomplish more. So I think that that's really what played a big role in me wanting to do what I like.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever or any of your family members personally benefited from the assistance of a social worker?
Not per se a social worker, but definitely I have a son that had some challenges, and I happened to receive some services for him from the Upstate Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Division in Syracuse, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. The woman that seen him, she just provided him with great care, and it was through her that I really started to understand, you know, what it meant to self-determination and the value and the worth of an individual. So it would be, you know, that's where my first real benefit was with working with somebody.
Mm. I can relate to it a little bit. When my mother was very ill and had to do some transitional planning from her stay at the hospital, one of the hospital social workers was so helpful in helping the family figure out what the next steps would be. So I know that social workers can play an extremely meaningful role in a person's life.
Yes,
speaking
they can.
Of people, and yeah, go ahead.
I agree. They really can. And sometimes I think the word social worker tends to scare people more than anything else, and they don't realize that social workers are there to really help people.
Right. Right. I know some people think, uh-oh, the system. Stay away from the system, you know. You know, but you're right. There could be a little bit of intimidation, but it's not founded in, you know, reality. So what were the influences, if any, like family members or teachers or anyone in your life who were particularly inspiring to you?
Well, when I was in high school, there was a teacher, Maxine Alberisi. She was just somebody that believed in me. And I always felt comfortable being able to reach out to her if, you know, if I needed to. And then as I got older, I found myself to be a single mom, and I ended up having to seek out some assistance from the Department of Social Services. And there was a woman there, she was a caseworker, and her name was Mrs. Smirdick. And I remember her telling me that it was okay, that she knew that this was only a temporary thing for me. And, you know, it was just those words, you know, for somebody to say it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it's really striking to have to go and get help, you know. But, mm-hmm. you know, I think that she had an impact on me, too, and I don't even think that she ever realized it.
Interesting. You know, it's just that sense that someone sees in you and is confident that you will get through this when you yourself, in the midst of the difficulties, might not see that light at the end of the tunnel. It's just, I'm sure, very encouraging, you know, to hear those words that this is temporary.
Yes, it really is, and I think that goes a long way, you know, with a person that could be down on their luck or, you know, just is really even having a bad day for that moment, you know.
Right, right. I remember one time that I had a job that I knew I had to leave, and I knew I had to leave it right away, and I knew I didn't have anything to go to, but I just knew it was the right thing to do to leave the job. And, of course, it did leave me unemployed for a while, and I remember receiving in the mail an envelope with $100 in it, and the person who wrote the note said, I know that you're in a temporary, you know, I know you'll get through this, or something to that effect. And she said, when you're on your feet again, maybe you could pass this forward. I was so amazed that, you know, someone believed in me enough to give me that money and that note. And it was just a wonderful experience to realize that someone recognized my human strength and goodness. So I hear what you're saying. Do you have someone you'd consider like a perfect role model?
Oh, boy. No, I don't have just someone. I have a few someones. And currently they would be professors that have stood behind me and have, you know, been in my corner even after graduation. One of them would be Jed Metzar, a great, great social worker, wonderful guy. Another one is Zelma Campbell. Again, another professor, and Scarlett Ackerley, you know, and it's if I could take all the, well, they all have great attributions to themselves, and it's just to roll them all up in one, it would be perfect, because they all have great strengths and qualities in, you know, in different arenas of their practice. And, you know, I've said to each of them at different times, if I can be half the social worker that they are, I will consider myself to be successful. I mean, they're just great, like I said, great people that have, you know, stood behind me and have believed in me in different times. And without them, there's been challenges that I have faced after graduation that I don't know if I would have made it, you know, without mm-hmm. them backing me.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think what you said about the fact that there are several that have different qualities that you'd like to say combined into one would be like a perfect role model makes a lot of sense, because sometimes you need that temperament that gives you like a quick, swift kick in the pants, you know, to kind of jolt you, you know, to face reality. And, you know, but then there's other times where you need that gentler approach, that more sensitive person. So, I mean, I'm sure that the range of temperaments have to vary according to the persons you serve.
Absolutely. Absolutely it does, you know, and that, you know, reflects to, you know, knowing who you are, you know, having a good sense of who you are and knowing yourself, and then knowing who you can work with and, you know, individuals that maybe that would be a little bit more challenging, and knowing all of that, you know, definitely makes you a better social worker and all around it, you know, take it out of social work, a better person, you know, you need to know your limitations.
Right. Could you just fill us in a little bit about your program, your Masters of Social Work program that was the foundation of your training?
Sure. It's a collaborative program between SUNY Brockport and Nazareth College in Rochester. The two colleges have come together to form the Masters of Social Work program, and it is obviously state accredited through the Department of Education, because it's at the end of it, it's you get licensed. That's the goal, is to get your license in social work. I chose that program over Syracuse University. I did get accepted there, but the reason I chose to travel 70 miles opposed to 25 was the ratio to students and to faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was I did the right decision. We had smaller mm-hmm. class numbers. There was probably about 19 in each class. And I think it made it that we were able to establish relationships with our professors, and they got to know us better and we got to know them well. And I think that that really made a good foundation for our education.
Mm-hmm.
So,
did you have any interesting field work assignments?
Yeah, I did. My first year, I was at a inpatient drug and alcohol center for women, and the unique thing about the place was that they were able to have their children with them, which I found that to be really unique. The children could be with the mothers if they were under school age, so that's from infant to probably four. And I thought that was really good, because, you know, the mother is getting help, and at the same yes. time, she's building a foundation with her, you know, her child, and
right.
reestablishing, you know, the connection there.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed that there. You know, addiction is faced everywhere. It knows no mm-hmm. boundaries. It doesn't matter if you're rich or you're poor, you're black or you're white or Hispanic. It doesn't matter. It hits everybody across all fields. And, you know, just to see the resiliency that an individual can have, I really noticed that there. That was a really learning experience for me. And just to know that it happens to the person next door, you know.
Yes.
And it's there. I mean, we turn on the news now and we hear about heroin, you know, and the lives
yeah.
that it's taking.
That
and it's just,
really
you know,
becoming...
it's devastating. Yeah.
Yes.
So
yes,
that, I found it to be very rewarding there. And another place that I did it was in a school.
Mm-hmm.
And that was obviously a complete different end of the spectrum from being in a school. The school social workers face different challenges, you know, where they're mainly confined to the school. You know,
mm-hmm.
They may not find as many resources outside of the school for, you know, for the children or for families. So for me, I found that restricting, and that's the part that I didn't like. But, you know, I understood, you know, what that role of that social worker is, you know, for the school. So it's that was learning there where you have to know what your boundaries are within your job description as well. So,
yes. But you like working with children themselves?
Yes, I do. Yep, I always have liked working with children. I have. And through this, I've realized that I like working with families as well, you know, the whole unit, which is key for children, which is key for the parents, you know, as you if you work with the with everybody. You know, if you only work with a part of the puzzle, the whole puzzle never seems to get put together. So in order for everything to come together and function, you need to work with everyone. So I like that approach.
Definitely. Well, from there, it seems like you have developed an interest in working with persons with criminal convictions. How did that happen?
How did that happen? Well, it happened, I think, in steps, and maybe it sometimes I didn't even realize it. In one area where I was working with some youth, you know, I would come across families that would have an incarcerated loved one, you know, whether it was mom or dad or a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle or a brother. You know, I would hear different stories of, like, when they came home and how they were challenged with finding a job. And, you know, like most people, I'd say, oh, it really can't be that difficult. It's, you know, that's just an excuse. They don't really want to work. And really what I came to find out was that is not an excuse. And the harsh reality is that with a criminal conviction, whether you've been in jail or not, the collateral consequences of a record can be devastating. And I can share a personal story of myself. I had filed for unemployment incorrectly in 2007, and I ended up having to plead to four felenies. And now here I am. I have an established work career. I now have an education, and I'm finding it extremely, extremely difficult to find employment. Now, obviously for the field of work that I do, there's a lot of background checks that you have to go through, and one of them is through the Department of Justice. Well, the Department of Justice has cleared me, you know, saying that I can, you know, work in different venues. But however, different agencies just choose still not to hire me, even after I have been cleared by the Justice Department. So I definitely know the challenge that that can bring about. So I think that's really where I really got hit right in the face with, I can relate to this, and I don't like how it goes, and I need to create change.
Right. Right. Well, like the way you describe what happened with you, it was kind of accidental. It was really nothing that you intended, but it seems like the consequences were extremely profound as far as your own life is gone.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I guess I could be mad, and I guess I could point a lot of fingers and come up with a million excuses, but the reality is that being ignorant to a situation doesn't make it okay. You know, and it can happen. It can happen to anybody. You can sort of like stumble upon it, not going and looking for it or not sitting down and plotting, you know, to sell drugs or to rob a house. There's just things that in everyday life that somehow that this can happen to you. And I don't think that a lot of people realize that avenue of it either. But nevertheless, however you get caught up in that system and then trying to navigate through it can be very, very, very difficult. And not knowing how to do it in itself can be frustrating. And then the whole effects afterwards are devastating, to say the least. And then trying to regain, you know, your life back, it's a lot of work, and it's not easy. I can say from my own experience, it is not easy at all. And if it wasn't for some of these people that I've had in my life, you know, I don't know what decisions I would have made, but I feel very fortunate that I've had positive reinforcements to stand behind me and that believed in me.
It is very lucky, yes, absolutely. Those, you know, emotional support system is so crucial. In your opinion, are there any sort of main reasons why people tend to get to the point of having to be incarcerated? You know, I know that there's the usual social ills, like we touched upon before, is substance abuse, which again can be kind of a slippery slope. I know that a lot of the heroin addiction right now kind of began with prescription drugs for many people.
Right.
And it kind of just led to the heroin. But I don't know, what would you say? What, poverty, lack of educational opportunities, breakups in the family?
All of it.
You know,
all of it.
All of the
above. I would say all of it. I would say survival, which will bring us back to poverty, excuse me, and which will bring us back again to lack of education, lack of support. So it's all intertwined. You know, it's that whole thing, we need to survive, and how are we going to survive? You know, there's just so many different avenues of how it can happen. And to just point to figure out one, I don't think that we could do it, because I think that if we were to sit down and talk to 5 or 10 different people, we would have 5 or 10 different ways of how it happened to them. But I just think a lot of it really relates back to trying to survive, trying to get your basic needs met, you know, whether it's that person that stole to buy food or stole to get shelter, or even for addiction. Because, you know, in the addict's mind, they need that fix to get to the next step, you know. So I would feel comfortable saying survival.
Yeah. I would imagine the idea of a sense of hopelessness might come into it, too. That usually if people have identifiable avenues to get what they need to survive, quite often they might go those routes rather than resort to criminal activity.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, you can go get assistance. Well, going and getting assistance isn't as easy as, you know, going into your local Department of Social Services. You know, they have their own rules and their regulations that they have to carry out as well. You know, if you're a mother with some children, you're, you know, help to you is a lot more and sometimes can be quicker than if you're a single male. You know, I know that there's a waiting process for cash assistance, and I believe that's 45 days. Well, let's face it, 45 days, a lot can happen to a person.
I'll say. That's over a month.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, you could end up being evicted. You know, you're phone or whatever is going to be shut off, you know, just any basic necessity isn't going to be met. So it's very difficult.
And then once the one by one the basic necessities aren't met, the harder it is to reengage with, you know, getting a job and, you know, finding the clothing that's appropriate for the job and getting transportation for the job and child care and the whole nine yards, you know.
Absolutely, that's right. It's the whole system that gets affected.
So could you describe the logistics of how you actually work with incarcerated individuals or those who are recently released?
Well, currently anything that I do right now is by word of mouth. I don't work for an agency that this is what I do for my job. Currently, the people that I've helped, like I said, it's been through word of mouth, you know. A gentleman had came to me and talked about being at the right place at the right time. I was in a position where I could do some hiring for a local factory, and word got out that I was there, and so some people came down, you know, that whether they were on parole or whether they had criminal convictions, you know, they felt that they were going to get a fair opportunity, you know, with me being there, and I was in a position where I was able to get some people hired, and this one gentleman that had been in and out of prison for very, very much of his young adult life came, and we hired him on, and he is now still with the company, and he has made it to be a supervisor, so I'm very proud of that, but like I said, anything that I do right now is just literally through word of mouth, people talking and, you know, tell them to get in touch with me and tell them how to get in touch with me, and that's how I've done it. I've just navigated a network of, you know, different connections of people that will, you know, may be able to help me help somebody else.
Would you like to give any contact information over the air right now?
Sure. I can contacted through my email, which is Melissa, M-E-L-I-S-S-A, White, W-H-Y-T-E, 69@gmail.com. That's generally the best way to get in touch with me, to send me a message, and I'm really good at answering them right away. And I will help the best that I can, or point them in the direction of where I think they can get that help. But being in Cayuga County and Auburn, we have very, very limited resources for, you know, this group of people.
Would you think, though, Melissa, that many of them among the group of people may be illiterate?
No, I don't think so. I don't. I don't think that they are. There may be some deficits in, you know, where their educational growth is, but I think that for the most part that they are okay. I do know that if you get incarcerated, one of the things is that they work on is getting the GED for people, so
that's
which
good.
Is a good thing.
Yeah.
But I guess if there's a positive, that could be it. But I think for the most part, people are stuck in a rut and don't know where to go.
Right. I just wonder about the digital divide. Do people, even if they do have some amount of literacy, do they have access to the computers?
Oh, yeah. Well, the only other way to get in touch with me is via my phone, which is, I can give out that number. It's 315-406-1633. And if you leave a message, I can return the calls that I get.
Thank you very much. It's very generous of you to give us that information. Now I wanted to just talk a little bit about those individuals who've been in prison who get out but then then find themselves back in the prison system. Could you talk about some of the reasons why you think this happens?
Well, I think recidivism happens due to a lot of things. One thing is that, you know, having a criminal conviction can stop you from obviously getting a job. It can sometimes stop you from getting public benefits. It can stop from subsidized housing. Basically, you're that person that's put on that back burner, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just think the fact that they become overwhelmed. You know, if they're on parole, they have stipulations that they have to obey by parole. You know, one of the things is that they want them to have a job. They want them to have stable housing. But unfortunately, parole officers aren't, you know, in a position where they can take on the role of case management, per se, you know, and help each parolee do those different avenues. And that's where it's so critical for communities to form reentry programs, you know, so that we can help reduce recidivism.
Right. I was just wondering, what kind of, do any programs like what you're describing exist right now in our local area? Like, are there like trans?
Yeah, no, unfortunately, no. There are some programs in Syracuse that do help with some transitional housing and supportive housing, but right here in Cayuga County in Auburn, we don't have anything. Right now, if you're released from parole and you don't have anywhere to go, you could be end up in the Chapel House, which is the men's homeless shelter, or you could end up being put up in a hotel. But there's no real support services or program that is going to help you get on your feet. A program that I'm aware of, and that if I am ever so lucky to have a program or work for an agency, I would want it to be like the Fortune Society. It's based out of New York City. And it's a full wraparound service. So what that means is that they deal with the whole person, you know, with every avenue. They deal with the family. They deal with mental health. They deal with substance abuse. They deal with other health services like testing for HIV, HIV education, anything, you know, that has to do with your health care. They have pre-release programs where they help the individual get the needed documentation that they're going to need, like IDs, Social Security cards, benefits, you know, everything that they may need that they're going to have to apply for any kind of benefits. And then they have somebody there that may help them apply for benefits or screen them for benefits that they may be entitled to. They have housing that helps formerly incarcerated individuals and their families get suitable, stable, affordable housing. And both it's long-term and short care housing that the program offers. They have employment services that help people get, maybe if you want a certificate in culinary arts or maybe construction, they help you, you know, with that part. And educational, they help with maybe GED or maybe somebody that would like to pursue a college education. And then the whole unit, like I said, is the family, where they help the families reconnect. They help the families bond. They give parenting classes. They help with child support issues and reunification issues as well. So they really address the person and the family as a whole. So it's everything that you can imagine that you would need. This agency, like I said, it's called the Fortune Society. They have it from beginning to end, and it's a great, great agency. I couldn't say enough
would any of
good
our
about
local,
it.
Would any of our local people be able to travel to that agency, or is it something that is only available to people in, is it the New York City area, did you say?
Yes, it is. And it is, and unfortunately that's what happens. These agencies are only able to help the individuals that live within their serving area. So down in New York City, it would be the five boroughs that they would be helping. In Syracuse, unfortunately, it's just Onondaga County. Same thing in Rochester. It's only Monroe County people that they're able to help, because it all comes from funding. So each county or each agency has to apply for that funding, and unfortunately, that's where the money has to go for, is the people in that county.
Wow. So we need to put some programs in place locally somehow.
Yes, we do. Yeah. Yes, you know, I've had the opportunity to talk to different people in Auburn, and, you know, they're all very supportive of it, but yet nothing is being done to get it here. you know, so I think that that's going to be a community effort. And, you know, and it also carries about a stigma, too, you know, being labeled as a ex-offender. You know, it has a stigma. People
yeah.
say, well, why do you want to help them? You know, so it's getting over that hurdle, you know, where the
yeah.
community needs to, you know, learn that there are going to be people that will continually go in and out of jail. There are going to be those people, but yet there yeah. are people that seriously want to change and have the ability to change and want to, but if there are not things in place for them, they can't.
Yeah.
So
there is like another dynamic here too, and that, you know, even Auburn, being a small city, has a great big huge prison, a very large
yep.
prison.
Yep.
And you know, it seems that because of the size, many of the people who live in Auburn are employed by that system. There's a lot of
mm-hmm.
corrections officers in the neighborhoods around the city. And, of course, probably wherever the ex-inmates would go, they perhaps could run into some of these correction officers, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And I don't...
It's, you know, it's always a possibility, but believe it or not, for
mm-hmm.
Auburn being the size that it is, and the amount
mm-hmm.
of inmates that are in there, the amount of inmates that get released from Auburn Correctional Facility and stay in Auburn are minimal. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've heard the story of, oh, no, their families move up here and, you know, they're living off the system and we're supporting them. That, I'm not saying that at times it does not happen, that people don't move and get closer to their loved ones, but more times than not, Auburn is not where they stay. They end up being released back to the county where the crime was committed.
Mm.
So, you know, that's that misconception, and that's where I think Auburn and the residents of Cayuga County as well need to understand that because we have two prisons here in the county doesn't necessarily mean that if we have a reentry program that we're going to get flooded with individuals, you know,
mm-hmm.
being released from those prisons, because that's really not the case. There goes a lot into when an individual gets paroled to where they're going to go. And like I said, more times than not, they're going to go back to wherever it is that they came, you know, the county that they came from.
Mm-hmm.
So
could you offer us a vision of, say, the optimal way that we could locally start assisting prisoners who want to reenter society?
Well, I think a lot of it has to start with the people that we elect. You know, we have to let them know that there's a need for it
mm-hmm.
and the importance of it. At the beginning of your segment, you talked about, you know, restorative, you
yes.
know, opposed to punitive. And that's really where where it starts. People need to start to embrace the idea of that. In fact, it was just over the weekend that I was reading an article that was in the New York Times, and it was called End Mass Incarceration Now, and it had some startling numbers, you know, in it. And I think people need to understand that incarceration should be a last resort. You know, we need to have a lot more rehabilitative services in
mm-hmm.
place, you know, especially for nonviolent crimes. You know, obviously violent crimes, we're talking to something different. But for a lot of
yeah.
the nonviolent crimes, we really need to see what we can do. You know, the report in the New York Times, it had stated that that now there's just about 2.2 million people incarcerated, and that's
wow.
a lot of people. Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
And then I suppose what makes it even stickier is the fact that a lot of people's employment depends on these prisons being sustained.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes when people hear reform, they think that the gates are just going to open and people are going to flood out, and that's not going to happen either. You know, obviously change takes time, and you know, during the change, you know, there's evaluations done, and everything has to be done, you know, in its own time. And I think that when they see the positives that can come out of it, that people will be more accepting of it. And I think it's just something that has to be educated. I think that's where we have to start, is educating the public about it,
yes.
You know, and people and being in fear of losing their jobs. I don't think that that is going to happen either. And I know people will say, well, we've already started to close some. Yes, we have.
Yeah.
But a lot of that goes with maybe we had too many to begin with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And by all means, I do think that the safety of the corrections officers should be taken into consideration, because you know what? Those men do not have an easy job either. You know?
No. No, not
so
at all.
I don't ever want to seem one-sided, you know, because there's always two sides. You know, those men and women that have that job, that's not an easy job for them to do either. And,
no.
You know, I think that sometimes that they have a good input, and I think that sometimes they can see where a change is needed. But, you know, if you sort of go against the norm, you know, you can be considered an outcast, and let's face it, who wants that amongst their coworkers, you know?
Right, right. I'm
so.
I'm
and
sure
I, that I think that their jobs could be placed differently, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we did more rehabilitative services, that they could be trained in different areas, you know. So maybe jobs wouldn't be lost. I mean, it's obviously it's this big system that we would have to look at, and you know, things could be rearranged and reassigned, but I think that that would be probably our best bet, and that if we started reentry at the point of incarceration, you know, because I would hope that the goal would be that everybody to some degree is reentering back into community. Obviously, there will be those ones that don't, that serve life sentences or, you know, constantly go in and out, but I think if we focus on what can we do to reduce recidivism, I think that we'll become a lot further.
Right. You know, I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, if we do have to make some tough funding choices, actually to put a lot of money into early education to help
mm-hmm.
us strong, you know, it's probably less costly. What does the saying go, that it's a lot less costly to give a child a good education and prevent the person from going to prison, you know, it's a better investment to put, you know, in a sense, into education of our youth so that they
mm-hmm.
have other options besides crime. The other aspect, too, that I wanted to touch upon was two things. One was the relationship of mental illness to the people who are incarcerated. And also, you know, we've been talking a lot about the external supports that we can give to or we can envision for the people being released. But we haven't really touched upon the inner work that needs to be done within each person that,
mm-hmm.
in a sense, allows them to experience their own inner dignity. I mean, you know, we can only do so much as far as the external supports, but each person has to kind of do some internal work too.
Absolutely.
And you know, I often know that I've heard that there's clergy and other sort of organizations that go into the prisons and try to offer some spiritual support to them. I don't know if that's effective or if they like that or if it's helped anyone. Do you know if it has?
I don't really know about that. You know, I guess the closest thing I could probably relate it to is the experience that I've had working in addiction, that, you know, it comes upon, you said, that individual, you know, to change. Mm-hmm. And like most anything, if a person isn't willing to change, no matter how much assistance or help is given to them, they're not going to. It has to be on their terms. You know, you have to meet that individual where they're at. And sometimes we have to accept people aren't going to change. And then we have to, you know, then we also have to be open to that there are the people that are going to change. And, you know, it's an individual case-by-case instance. You know, I wish it would be easy to say everybody wants to change and everybody wants to be better and, you know, to do, you know, what's needed for them to be productive. But the harsh reality is that it's not like that. And you also talked about mental health. Mental health is huge in our prisons and in our jails. Unfortunately, again, you know, talking about how they're housed and stuff, that a lot of those services aren't there, you know, for mental health. You know, they do have, you know, the hospital, and they do have some services in there. But for the most part, again, the guards, I don't feel as if are given proper training on how to identify or how to handle individuals that have, you know, a mental health issue, you know. And again, I think that that plays on their safety.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
You know, I do feel, I feel like sometimes that they aren't given the proper training on how to do that. You know, there's not a one-size-fits-all, you know, and I do understand that their whole thing is that they have hundreds of men and co-workers that they need to keep safe. And being able to distinguish, you know, different ways of how to handle a different inmate because of their situation, that's very difficult. And I can relate to that when I did residential care, you know. Granted, it was only 18 boys or 18 girls that were on a unit, but still, it's very difficult when you have all those personalities going on. It can create, you know, a dangerous situation. So for them, I would say, again, it's training for our guards that are have that job.
Right. Yeah, 18 is a lot of people. And if, you know, if one starts doing something and you have to focus on that, then 17 others can be doing something that who knows what, you know.
Absolutely. And, you know, my experience is with youth, and, you know, they're dealing with adults.
Yes.
So,
well, some of our listeners this evening, we might suppose, have been prisoners at some point in their life. And I was wondering if there's something you can say that may be encouraging to them.
Well, the best advice I can give them is don't give up. That there's going to be plenty of roadblocks, there's going to be plenty of hurdles, but I believe that if you don't give up, you will succeed, and eventually you will get where it is that you need to be, and you will find the right people that are going to help you, you know, in your journey. And I just think, just don't give up. Don't give up. And I just, and I know how hard it is to have that door shut day after day after day. No, I'm sorry, we can't help you. No, I'm sorry, we can't hire you. You know, it's very defeating, but you just can't give up. You've got to believe in yourself. You've got to believe in a higher power. And I think that's the probably the best advice I can give to somebody.
That's great.
You know, and the other thing I would suggest is that you talk to somebody. I mean, whether it's a member of your church, a family member that you can talk to, or seek out counseling, you know, go to a social worker, go to mental health and talk to somebody, because being able to talk through what you're going through can really help. You know,
absolutely.
It can help with that anxiety, and, you know, you guys can come up with maybe different options and stuff like that. But I think that that's it. You've got to find a good positive support network.
Right. Melissa, in the prison, do they have 12-step program meetings or no?
I believe that they do. Yes, they do. They do have
good.
Those, and they have some other programs in there that I'm really, I can't speak on them because I don't know enough about them to be able to speak on them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask you also, for those listeners who may want to be forgiving but who still find themselves suspicious or afraid to get involved with former prison inmates, is there something you could offer in the way of advice?
I would say that jump into it. Just take that leap of faith and just believe that people can change and that want to change. I wish that there was a program closer that they could sort of like look at and see the success stories, but the only thing I can offer is for them to go onto the Fortune Society's website and to just see the wonderful work that they've done with those individuals down there in New York City.
Great. So what is your dreams for yourself in the coming years?
It is my dream, it is my goal and my passion to eventually hope and help Cayuga County have a reentry program. That's what it is.
I lost you. Hello? Oh.
Yes. Hello?
Melissa?
Yes, I'm here. Oh. Hello?
Melissa?
Yeah, I'm here.
I lost you.
Oh, no, I'm here.
Oh.
I'm still here.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I just lost you. Okay,
oh, no, I was here. I could hear you.
Oh, you could? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Could you just repeat what you just said? That your vision for yourself in the coming years, your dreams?
Is that Cayuga County will have a reentry program, and I hope that I can be a part of getting one here.
Oh, I think you would be awesome. And what is your vision for a better world?
Oh, boy, a better world. I think for a better world, if we could just, like I said earlier, learn to see the better in people and not focus so much on the negative. You know, everybody has something good to bring to the table, and if we could start to focus on that and build upon that, I think that we would get a lot further.
Well, Melissa, I thank you so much for being with us this evening, and thank you for sharing your insights and your passion with our listeners.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
It is our pleasure. So this concludes this episode of Your Turn to Speak. Please tune in again next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time for another program. But in the meantime, may your voice be heard.
We are all one planet, all one people of Earth, all one planet.
You have been listening to Your Turn to Speak with host Beth Miller. Each week, Beth features guests whose important views are often overlooked in the mainstream dialogue. You can listen to this show again at freespiritbroadcasting.com. And be sure to tune in next Tuesday at 6 p.m. Eastern for another live, inspiring conversation on Your Turn to Speak.
Our dying, our birth, and we walk.